never causes harm to give someone a bit of your time, to have that coffee, to have that sit down, to listen to someone else's problem. It doesn't cost you anything, and sometimes you can help and sometimes you can't. But I think people appreciate the effort to do it. And I think that that's true at all levels, whether it's a genuine problem or whether it's just about making those connections. You never know when you're going to cross paths with people.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ben Morton Leadership Podcast. It's the weekly show that brings you inspiring interviews with senior leaders and thought leaders from all around the world. And it's all designed to help you be the very best leader you can possibly be. It's my gift to you and it's completely free. Now, I've noticed there is a growing number of you tuning in from Spain. So to those of you listening in Spain, let me just say hola y gracias por escuchar. In today's episode of the show, we have the privilege of chatting with Andy Lightfoot, who is the impressive CEO of Space NK. Andy Lightfoot is a modern CEO with a rich background in retail, spanning both traditional and digital platforms. His journey includes leadership roles in global organizations and a comprehensive understanding of the complexities of managing a large business. With a focus on analytical and creative approaches, Andy has steered companies through both successes and setbacks, which has shaped his distinctive perspective on effective leadership. In this episode specifically, you are going to learn tips from Andy on getting your first CEO role, if that's what you're aspiring to, and more generally, how to get your next promotion whilst building a great reputation at the same time. We also look at strategies for making tough decisions, how to be lucky, and wait for it, why you should not do the things you want to do. Plus, as always, lots more. In this episode, you'll also hear me reference the interview I did with General David Petraeus. That's episode 57, and I've included a link in the show notes for you so you can listen to that one next. It's an absolute cracker and one of the top 10 most downloaded episodes of all time. That's enough by way of an introduction, though, and let's dive right in. Here is my interview with Space NK CEO Andy Lightfoot. Andy, can I start off by asking you to share with our listeners, what is your first memorable leadership experience, good or bad, in the workplace? And how has that gone on to shape you as a leader yourself?
I had a think about this and I wanted to share actually probably not my first, but a really defining leadership experience. So when I moved from Amazon to Arcadia, which was around about nine and a half years ago, I moved from a fairly loose hierarchical structure to a very hierarchical structure. When I came in, I came really as the subject matter expert. It was a big transformation project. You know, I'd done a load of that sort of digital transformation at Amazon. And what I became was effectively in every meeting, trying to become the alpha. And it was the culture that I was moving into, but it was one that I fell into far too easily and adopted. And I found this sort of behavior of constantly trying to exert control over a meeting and then taking that back and really trying to exert command and control over my team. So it closed down a lot of what I'd learned from Amazon around listening, around very collaborative work groups, around completely non-hierarchical teams and working with all different people and valuing all behaviors to one of, I'm the loudest person in the room, so we're going to do what I think. And it took that experience really to understand what leader I wanted to be, almost that really sort of negative leadership experience of how I wanted to behave, as opposed to adopting other people's leadership experiences. I think I needed to look in the mirror and reflect on how I had done it, what I'd done well in the past, and then really having to have a negative experience to give me that reflective view.
Mm. I'd love straight away to ask a few more questions on that, Andy, if I may. Like, at what point did you start to notice your style and approach changing? Did it feel quite uncomfortable where you were trying to be that alpha, the dominant one, or Yeah. How did that unfold? And what was the moment when you realized, like, this isn't me, this doesn't feel right, I'm changing?
I remember a meeting very definitely where I was sat with a lady that worked for me who was already in the business. So I had come in as her boss, and we were sat with the managing director of the brand, and we were being challenged on some of our numbers, some of our performance. It was pretty early in my time there. It was probably within the first couple of months. And I remember this almost sort of point scoring dialogue going on. You know, she would say something. So the person that worked for me would say something. I would try and give a fact that sort of overrode that. And even at the time, and I remember it very, very vividly now, even at the time, I was just thinking, what is this that I've fallen into? But unfortunately, that wasn't the kick up the bottom I needed to kind of adjust that. It was very much the culture of the company. And I think it was a realization that you have to pick your companies carefully on that culture. I think you can go in and change and be successful behaving differently from a company culture. It's possibly true, but I think difficult. But also you have to sort of define how you want to behave and not allow yourself to fall into that. Because once you're into it, it is quite difficult to come out. As I said, that was possibly month two. I was there for 18 months in that type of culture. But I think having lived that, it gave me a really clear inverse blueprint of how I actually wanted to behave.
That's interesting as well. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with my wife. I can't remember when it was. And we was talking about company culture. And I guess to a degree, what you're willing to put up with and tolerate at various stages in your career. And it came about because my wife, Jo, was saying, do you know what? I've worked for enough companies now and I'm senior enough now where, like, if the culture isn't right, like, I'm not going to put up with that anymore. Whereas I think earlier on in your career, this isn't to say whatsoever that we should stay somewhere if it really doesn't fit, or we should put up with like really bad behavior and a really toxic culture. But I do think there's an element of when you're much more junior, what's important is gaining the experience, right? And the breadth on your CV. So she was saying, well, maybe you do tolerate a bit more, but as you get more senior, you know what you like, what you don't like, you know what good looks like, what bad looks like, and you almost don't need to accept it so much. Do you have a view on that?
I do, but I'm gonna lean on the cliche of generations, but in the inverse of how it's often used, that I think we talk a lot, or you know, my generation talk a lot about the younger generations, and they've got no staying power. You know, they have certain expectations of a job, and if they're not met, then they're off. And I think one of the flaws of my generation was that was admitting defeat. So you could be in an awful culture, you could be miserable, but you know, I'm gonna stick this out. This is about survival, this is character building. And all the things you said there about, I've got to get the experience, I've got to get this on my CV, I've got to get a great reference, I've got to get that next promotion, and you're miserable. And I think there's a happy medium, right? I think, you know, you can have extremes on this spectrum, but I think a lot of what I put up with in certain workplaces of pretty negative behavior that I don't think would be tolerated at all nowadays, we did put up with, and it was just normal. And it was, as I say, character building. I think as you get more senior, you are more able to define and dictate what some of that looks like. But I wouldn't underestimate what it takes to make that change and how uncomfortable that could be. And I think that's the thing that comes with seniority. You can decide whether you really want to fight that battle or not. Are you going to put the effort into making the change, or are you going to go somewhere else where it's already a more comfortable culture for you? And different cultures suit different people. This is not about defining this is what good looks like and this is what bad looks like. It's for you what good looks like and what you know how you want to work.
It's such a great point, isn't it, that it can be easy to forget that hindsight is always through rose-tinted glasses. We remember the best bits, forget the worst bits. But it's a really interesting distinction there. And I think you're right, like we're probably similar generation in the workplace, right? And it was about like tolerating it, putting up with it, kind of toughness. And it was a very different view, wasn't it? Or different approach to work. And a lot of that actually wasn't helpful. I think where we are now, where we are talking about mental health and well-being in a very different way, it's highlighting some of the, I don't know, bad working practices that perhaps went on, and everything evolves and changes, right?
It does. And I think it's this thing around choice. So people often say, you know, choice is a curse. Having the ability to choose between many things, and I think, you know, in the generation, in that early workplace, our generation, you kind of got a job, you worked your way up, you built experience, you moved on. And with luck, you went to places that suited you better and better. I think you were also being defined by that workplace because we didn't have the sort of level of social openness that exists now. So you had friendship and peer groups that could tell you what their work cultures were like, but we didn't have the level of internet exposure, social media that said, this is what a good company looks like and this is what a bad company looks like. And these are the perks that they're getting and you're not getting them. None of that openness existed. You know, choices are, I've been known to say, it's a luxury of the fortunate, right? So choice, sometimes people say it's a curse. It's really difficult. I can do this. I don't know what to do. I can't make my mind up. Well, you have to look at that through the lens of actually, you're really fortunate to have those choices. So use them wisely. Sometimes the right choice is to tough it out. And sometimes the right choice is to jump somewhere else. But right back to the first point is you do learn a lot from those bad experiences, recognizing the negative as well as the positive, because it builds a three-dimensional playbook, as opposed to just saying, right, well, I can copy these good things that I've learned. To build your own leadership style, I actually think you need the things you're not going to do. It leaves those blank spaces that you start to fill in yourself.
Yeah. As I listen to you talking there, it strikes me that to your point around choice being a real luxury, there's an element of sort of white privilege in that as well, right? Kind of you and I, middle-aged white men, like, great, we've got that choice, but not everybody does.
No, not everybody does. And I think using it wisely and understanding that it is a privilege, the decisions that you make through your career should be about allowing you to expand those choices that you have in future life. You know, my mum actually put it best. She said, you've got to try your hardest at school and through your education because it keeps doors open. You know, if you end up being a bricklayer, a plumber, a NASA scientist, that's up to you in later life. But if you've closed those doors and you can't be those things and that's what you want to be, then it's too late. So you put real effort through every stage of your life to keep the doors open to the things that you might want to do, as opposed to funneling yourself down really early and finding, actually, this wasn't the route I wanted to take and there's no way out at that point.
That's a nice little segue, actually, back to a follow-up question I wanted to ask, Andy, based on something you said earlier. And I used to ask this all the time in the podcast, but I've not asked it for a long time. And then after this, maybe we'll get back to some of the questions I thought I'd ask you. But when we were talking about sort of our generation, getting a job, sticking it out, working hard, trying to get the promotion, you said with a bit of luck, you might get that promotion. I always used to ask guests on the show about luck. So in terms of career progression, do you think you personally have been lucky? Do you believe in luck? Or are you more of the mindset that we make our own luck?
The former. I mean, do I believe in luck? I feel it's going down another line of questioning. But, you know, just in the world, more
it's slightly curious, philosophical. But
yes, I've been incredibly lucky because I think to get to the senior position, certainly to become a CEO, there's a huge amount of luck involved. I'd genuinely be surprised if anyone said any different because you have to be good, right? So I'm not taking away, you have to have talent, you have to have vision, you have to have all the requisite skills, but so do 10 other people. And so how do you become the one out of that 10? And there's a huge amount of sort of right place, right time, right sponsor. So if I look at that progression for me, there are a whole myriad of sliding doors moments. It wasn't one thing where it could have gone either way. It's probably a culmination of four or five things that had to fall in a very definitive direction for me to get this role. And I was promoted within a company. So I was global digital director, promoted to chief executive. And I think that's quite an unusual progression. I think there's a few more of those happening now, but yeah, this was nearly 6 years ago that happened. And certainly wasn't really a well-trodden progression path.
I guess more traditionally, it's finance, chief operating officer, chief commercial officer, right?
Yeah. And I think often sideways, I think often you get that promotion sideways, which again has a huge amount of luck to it. But, you know, the previous chief executive was retiring. The business was going through a significant transformation. There was a significant external event that was sort of driving a complete rethink within the board. So all of these things just had to come together for it to work out for me. Now, I'm not going to downplay the skills that I brought to the role or the role that I've done or the performance that I've driven, but that was all allowed because of luck. And had it gone to open CVs and people been interviewed because they didn't go through that process, I was sort of championed into the role. Would I have got the role against 9 other candidates who had all been CEOs for 3, 4, 5 years previously and proven that they could run this role? I doubt that I would. Certainly if I was the hiring manager, I would have looked at my CV with less conviction than people that had been there and done it. So yes, significant amount of luck.
Quick one for you. You've just heard Andy and myself talking about luck. Well, if you're looking for your next leadership role or want to succeed in your current one and don't want to leave success down to luck, then hiring a coach or mentor is always a great investment to make. I've included some links in the show notes to the coaching and mentoring pages of my website, ben-morton.com, and there's also a link for you to book a free discovery call. It's all in the show notes for you. Back to the episode. And without turning this into a court case or an argument where I'm trying to get you to change your view, at the same time, how much do you think comes down to sort of putting yourself in the time and place where you can be lucky, about putting yourself in the place where those lucky, in inverted commas, opportunities present themselves to you? And the reason I kind of partly asked that is when I heard General David Petraeus on the podcast, he said, luck is where preparedness meets opportunity, which I liked. And I don't think it's a black or white distinction, right? It's not kind of you make your own luck or you're lucky. It's definitely a combination of the two. But I'm just always intrigued to explore how people go about making themselves lucky, if that makes sense.
I think I agree with that. I think that's a really, really succinct way of putting it, is that, you know, when that opportunity arises, let's say that happens once in your life, are you ready to take it? And I think that's what that gets to, the nub of it. You still need that one opportunity to come along. You still need to be in the right place at the right time. But if you're in the right place at the right time, but you're not ready, you know, you haven't developed yourself enough, you haven't proven enough in the roles that you've had, you haven't developed your leadership skills and your leadership style sufficiently, you haven't put your head above the parapet sufficiently to be seen. And if you haven't done all those things, that you're going to miss that chance. It's going to pass you by. So that's why I say, I think, you know, you have to have all of those things. That's a given. I still think you need that moment to come along. And yes, there are ways that you can make it happen for yourself, or you can increase the probability. You know, you're far more likely to become CEO operating in small organizations than you are sitting in big organizations, right? If I'd stayed in Amazon, I would definitively not be chief executive. So by leaving and making what at the time was a very brave decision of this huge, enormously successful company, I was very well thought of there. I was being championed for sort of a fast track career. But I made the decision to leave because what I saw was exactly what you talk about. Just this forever career within Amazon, working at, you know, yes, ever more senior levels, but as a slightly bigger cog in an ever bigger machine, as opposed to trying to define something. I had a very clear plan of my career from an early age, and I stuck to it even when I missed the milestones. So I wanted to be a director at the age of 30, which I didn't achieve. And I wanted to be a chief executive by the age of 40, which I did. I was 37 when I became chief executive. So when I didn't achieve that 30, I think it's easy to go, okay, well, I've missed that, so I've got to reset all my priorities, or I've got to come up with new. And I didn't. I stuck to it, and I was in arrears. So what am I going to do to get to that director level? What is it going to take for me to get there, rather than moving the goalposts, moving it out and resetting expectations? But what I'd add to that, actually, it was when I relaxed a bit about it that I really progressed the most. So when I was super ambitious and super hungry for promotions, I wasn't getting them. You know, you could smell the desperation. It was actually when I chilled out a little bit, when I relaxed into the role. And some of that was with life stage, with having children and different life stages where, you know, you go from having a single goal in life, single, you know, objective, to having to have a more balanced work life. Some of it was maturity, just getting a bit older, but some of it was just actually just somewhere within me. It was just a little bit less important, but it was always my goal. I never let go of that.
When you missed the director one, did you push the chief exec goal back, or did you leave it in the same, left in the same time frame?
No, it was always, and 30 seems really early, and it seemed really early then, but I had a director who was 29, my first job. So I worked for Currys Dixons. It was DSG International when I was there. They keep changing their name. So a guy called Carl Cowling, who's now CEO of WH Smith, he was my director. He was 29. And so that set, I was like, right, well, he's done it, so I'm going to do it. And when I didn't do it, no, I was pretty hard on myself. I was very down. My 30th birthday was not the day itself, but I had a couple of weeks of reflection. And you know, that was sort of my midlife crisis, if you like, of, well, why haven't I got here and what have I got to do to do it? But yeah, what I found is the points where you really just do the job you're in really well, rather than constantly trying to aspire to the next role, actually that leads to the next role far quicker. Some of the best work I've ever done was in the 3-month leaving period of Amazon. Because I was leaving, it didn't matter. And the level of positive feedback I got from very, very senior people, people I've been trying to impress for 5 years in that 3 months, was night and day to when I was really trying to impress them, because it just relaxed. I was just doing my job really well rather than trying to do something I perceived they would want me to do.
Yeah. God, this is fascinating. There's so many questions and things we could explore off the back of this. And the first thing that strikes me is what you're sharing there, I 100% believe in and agree with. And I think it can be such a hard lesson to learn from other people, can't it? Like, people can listen to you and I sharing our experiences of that, and to go and act on that and to relax and not to worry about the promotion can be so hard. And people can very easily say, oh, that's great, Ben, that's great, Annie, but you're already in those roles, so don't tell me just to relax and it'll come. But from a logic perspective, even from a neuroscience perspective that I've studied, there's so much evidence that says that approach works. Just focus on doing the current job really well. It's to your point, like, no one buys from a desperate salesman. If you're just trying to chase the promotion, all the work becomes actually about you rather than doing the work or enabling your team, right? And then the bit you shared around sort of life stage and relaxing, like, I talk about that all the time now from a neuroscience perspective. So this idea of slowing down to speed up, when we do that, when we disconnect, entire different regions of the brain light up, which are all the parts we use for creativity, creative problem solving, making sense of our emotions and team dynamics. So those moments where we go for a walk with a dog, or we're pushing the kids along a high street in the pushchair and grabbing a cup of coffee, the brain is just subconsciously processing everything at work, and you go back with insights and ideas. But again, it's hard to accept that advice or insight from other people.
It is really hard, but I'll give an example that perhaps can anchor it for some people. So when I was at Amazon, I was in a, I suppose what would be a middle management position. So sort of senior management reporting into a director, but it's a big organization, so there's lots of layers. But as I said, fairly unhierarchical. And how promotions worked on paper was a very sort of logical, methodical process of, you know, have you achieved all of these things? In reality, it was, have you impressed the right person at the right seniority? So the really senior guys would get in a room and go, oh yeah, I've heard of Andy, he's done some good stuff. Yeah, he gets my vote. And it would be almost a sort of old boys club blackball system. So what they purportedly was and what it really was. And if you assume that that's how promotions happen in any company you're in, then if it's better than that, then you'll be all right if you act with that mindset. How I reacted to that was, right, how do I get in front of, how do I brown nose the right person, right? Say it how it is. How do I brown nose the right person? How do I get in front of that VP and impress him with some project? So I'm going to pick my project based on what they're involved with, or not my interests, not what I'm good at, not my passion. So you're working yourself pretty thin, trying to cover off and impress all of these people who don't even know you're trying to impress them. They don't know, or they certainly pretend not to know. They don't really care because they're looking across the whole organization. Also, there's a bit of, they've had to go through the process. So there's a bit of that, well, it was tough for me, so I'm going to make it tough for you attitude as well, layered on. Now, the change for me was when I flipped it and I said, well, what if I don't be that person? What if I become the person that can get the person beneath me promoted? So I become the conduit, right? So there's all these blocks that exist within this organization. It's super hard. And I had to go through the process, I think, 3 times, which means 3 years. There's only one time a year. So this is pretty punitive. Someone says no, some manager that you didn't impress in the right way, you've got to wait a year. So having been through it and, well, failed it twice, succeeded the third time, I had a pretty clear blueprint of what you needed to do. So I just made it really transparent for teams. And I became like, if you want to get promoted, go and work for Andy. He's in a pretty tough department, and it's, you're going to have a year working hard, you'll get the outcome. And that reflected incredibly well on me above. So instead of thinking, well, how am I going to impress the teams above? It was completely reversing it and saying, well, let me make this easier for the people trying to come through. Let me forge a path that others can follow. And actually, that massively benefited me. And I can genuinely say that isn't why I did it. I didn't do it going, ha, I've got this master plan. That made me look good. It was like, this is a really tough process. And there's some really good people. That's one way I could try and make it tangible for people listening of, yes, I can give all the hypothetical advice, but actually, you know, doing something for others reflects really, really well on you. Even, you know, whether it comes from the right place or not, doesn't matter. If you now go away and do that because you think it will get your promotion, that's also fine. But, you know, do it genuinely, do it properly, help people beneath you. That is more noticed than any project you can do with some guy that you've got to impress in another department.
Yeah, and building on what you've said there, it strikes me that the approach you found, the probability of getting a promotion as a result of doing that, has got to be more than 50-50. It also strikes me the old approach of who do I need to impress, how do I brown nose them, it strikes me that at best, that's probably 50-50, because in trying to impress those people and taking on the projects that maybe don't suit your strengths or passions, you're not going to be playing at your best. So they might not see the best of you. Along the way, you're probably going to end up trampling on a few people. So it's not going to put you in a good light. So
no, and I don't think you're laying any foundations, because I think if you think of promotions, you know, let's say you're at that stage, you're at middle management. How many times are you willing to go through that cycle? So you do it once, you get that one promotion, great. You know, speaking for myself, immediately you're like, when's the next promotion? How do I get to the next level? It's not great. I'll relax for a couple of years. I'm really happy. It's naked ambition. So then you've got to go again. You've got to go again. Well, how full's your tank? If you're doing things you don't really enjoy with people you don't necessarily respect, or you're not getting anything back from that, it empties you pretty quickly. Whereas if you find a way to do it that is fulfilling, that builds foundations. You're building, you know, the building is coming up underneath you to support you. And I think the other thing that I found from that approach was, because of that, I was incredibly well known across the organization, because I had this sort of cohort of people that I'd helped through. They were then in other departments talking about me. You know this Andy guy? Oh yeah, of course I know Andy. He's done this, this, and this, and this. And you know, all those sort of other benefits of this positive echo chamber that you've created through your own hard work. There's plenty of people to help you out when you've got a problem, when you do have to do that one bit of brown nosing, because you absolutely do have to get that guy on your ticket. Well, I've got 6 people that are going to help me because I help them. So I think sort of going through that sort of artificial cycle is pretty tough. And I think that's why you see people leave businesses. It's sort of, you run out of steam, right? And so you take the hop across into a new business. It gives you fresh impetus. You can start afresh to the people that perhaps you've cheesed off or alienated or isolated, and you try and go again. But I think there's another way of doing it.
And I think even if you do it the other way, I think even when you move companies, like people move around, right? Nearly every industry is quite, we all say it's quite a small world, but people move around, and sometimes your reputation precedes you, sometimes your reputation follows you, right? Like, in sort of full transparency, we ended up talking on this podcast through my wife, who's in the same sector. You've never worked together. She speaks very, very highly of you and says, oh, Andy is very well thought of in the industry. So it clearly works, right?
I think it does. I think it never causes harm to give someone a bit of your time, to have that coffee, to have that sit down, to listen to someone else's problem, it doesn't cost you anything. And sometimes you can help and sometimes you can't. But I think people appreciate the effort to do it. And I think that that's true at all levels, whether it's a genuine problem or whether it's just about making those connections. You never know when you're going to cross paths with people again. We have it very much within the beauty industry. So we get presented hundreds and hundreds of brands every month, and the vast majority of them are not going to be commercially viable. And the biggest skill is to land that in the nicest possible way, because you don't know what that founder will come up with next. So the brand that is, and I'm putting it very politely here, not commercially viable, the next thing they might be the blockbuster. And you want them to knock on your door again with that next brand. So I think it's that mindset, you know, of you never want to close a door. You just never know what's going to be behind it the next time you open it.
And Andy, talking about promotions and the journey to promotion, you said when we spoke in advance of today's recording that your transition from, I think, digital director to chief exec wasn't what you thought it was going to be. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you meant by that? Like, what was different? What surprised you?
Yeah, particularly the chief exec role was that I wasn't prepared for how unpopular the decisions I made would be. And I'm gonna describe that, and I'll give a little anecdote to back it up. So, in 2016, I was in South by Southwest, and Barack Obama, who was in his second term, sitting president, came to speak. So it was originally a music festival. I'm sure you're aware, Ben, but originally a music festival. It's now this. It's called the Interactive Festival, but it brings together just the greatest speakers from all business topics together for sort of about a week to talk, and there's about 30 concurrent sessions every hour from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. for 7 days straight. So to give you a level of the speaker, Barack Obama, sitting president, came to speak. It was a closed session, wasn't filmed, and he said, you have to cut government a break because any easy decisions are solved by capitalism, right? So if there's a bit of money to be made, if there's an edge to be had, capitalism solves it. It's only the really, really big, really, really difficult problems that are left for government. So global warming, climate change, these huge issues with transient workforces or immigration, or just these massive social problems, hunger in the US, obviously health and insurance. And so let me shrink that down to like 0.1% of Barack Obama's problem. That's what you get as chief executive. So I have an incredibly, extraordinarily talented organization, incredible people that work for me. So everything's answered. Yes, I might be informed, I might be consulted, I'll be brought in, but fundamentally they know the answers. They can figure out these problems. The things that they can't figure out, therefore, are really, really difficult, really nuanced, generally really unpopular. So it's a 51-49 type split. So half of the work population are going to think I've made the wrong decision. And that I wasn't prepared for. That was a heavy weight to carry, that, you know, all of the things that my name was against, half of the work population thought that I'd got it wrong. And I'll give you an example. So shortly after I'd been promoted, I wanted to fundamentally change the organizational structure of the business. And it was working. So there was nothing fundamentally wrong with it. It was working, but I could just see that in the sort of vision and strategy for the future, it would become a constraint. So better to change it now before I needed to change it. I needed to change it under pressure than change it at a later date. It gave me the benefit of time. So I took my senior leadership team and it took me probably almost 6 months to get them on board, constantly talking to them about it, constantly using examples of issues that we were having and how this new organizational structure would help. So you think about that. These are, you know, I could just tell them to do it, right? No, we're doing it and we're doing it tomorrow and this is happening. So I took 6 months to really get them on board and for them to be ready to make the change. And then we went through probably another 6 months of actually doing it, of taking people through and defining the new roles, putting people in place, big supportive structure, everybody at the time at various points. So my senior team, when I first broached it, through to when we started to make it public, thought it was wrong. And criticised me for it. And I'm sure they were all down the pub, you know, having words about your boss just like you do. And it was a really, really lonely place, but I knew that it had to be done. That was my job. That was the role of the chief executive, was to foresee what you needed to do in the future and do it before it needed to get done. that's, and without sort of going into the details of the organizational change, you know, some very close friends of mine within the business actually ended up leaving the business as a result, and it was very, very difficult. But that wasn't, I wasn't prepared for that. I wasn't prepared for the scale of decisions. I think you look at that role and you go, well, they're really strategic. They get to make a lot of the fun decisions. They can make the big decisions and they can sort of get involved with what they want. And while some of that is true, the reality, if you want to be a good chief executive, is one of the biggest disciplines is staying out of the things you want to get involved with. Because the things you want to get involved with are fun, but don't often need you. They're fun because they're easy, and you're where you don't need to be. Where you need to be are the really sticky, really difficult, really unpopular places. And yeah, that was tough. And it took about 2 years to get comfortable with that, if I'm honest.
Andy, how do you develop that discipline to stay out of those things? Because I get asked this a lot, because the military is renowned for being very, very disciplined. And I think about it a lot, and short of saying go to Sandhurst for 11 months, which is highly unhelpful, I don't really know how you go about building discipline. Like, one way to start is maybe start by doing small, seemingly insignificant things that you don't really want to do, so you get used to it. Because for me, that's what a big part of discipline is, right? I don't want to do that, but I know it's the right thing to do, so I'm going to keep showing up, keep doing it. But how, very specifically, in terms of staying out of the easy stuff or the stuff that you're passionate about, how do you do that?
There's two sides to it. How do you force yourself to do the difficult stuff? Find some confidence. So if you've got a board or an advisors or a mentor, and say it out loud really early. Because as soon as you say it out loud, that person will hold you to account and sort of push you forwards. Because it's with the organization, I'm using that example. You know, I said it out loud and then to a couple of people within my board, and then they started playing it back to me. And I was like, oh God, I wish I'd never said it, because now they're hassling me. They're like chasing me to get it done. You know, I shared the vision of it. I shared what it would solve. And they were like, you're right. So when are you going to do it? And if I hadn't done that, I could have procrastinated forever. Because as I said, it was okay how it was. On the flip, you've got to be really conscious of it. I don't think there's a magic formula. And I think as well, you can allow yourself to get involved in stuff you want to do, right? It shouldn't be a bleak, lonely workplace. So, you know, it's not a black and white, all or nothing type role. But you've got an organization to do the work. And I think you've got to respect how they want to do it. So how I do it is I allow them to invite me in. I use the time that I have with my senior leaders, say, I'm really interested in this. Talk to me about these brands. Talk to me about, you know, how you're thinking about this strategic piece. And I allow them to invite me in deeper. And there's lots of hints and lots of nudges I can give them to encourage that to happen. But that is very different from saying, right, I'm going to get involved or I'm going to make any of these decisions. It is a discipline. And I think part of being a chief executive, which also surprised me, and it very definitely wasn't the case for a good few years, it's probably a combination of I'm now much more experienced in the role and the company is doing very, very well, is that at times it's very boring. Because one of the biggest disciplines of being a leader, and I think it becomes more exaggerated the more senior you are, is knowing when to just leave everyone alone, right? They've all got all their plates spinning. You've got time on your hands, and the biggest mistake that you can make is believing that because you've got time on your hands, they've got time on their hands, and you got. And I'm constantly coming up with ideas of varying quality, right? So, here's the next idea I've got. Let's go after this. Let's chase this rabbit. Let's go down this hole. Let's do this. But if you do that, you derail everything that you've built. So one of the biggest disciplines is going, okay, everything's going as we want it to do. Everything's happening. I have to just leave everyone alone. And be comfortable with that. Be comfortable with sort of, in inverted commas, doing nothing. You're never doing nothing, but you know what I mean. You read between the lines.
That can be a challenge as well, right? I remember back to my first career in the military, and especially some of the latter exercises I did when I was training at Sandhurst, where you step into more and more senior leadership roles. When I was doing a headquarters job, like in the headquarters in the operations room, there's this real desire to want to chase the troops on the ground who are literally sort of in the battle with the enemy, chasing them for updates. But you suddenly go, actually no, like I've been in their shoes. I know there's loads going on. Just leave them to it. When they give me the information or when there's a pause, when I really need it, then I'll chase them. But just backing off is so key. And it's the, I guess it's one of the traps of leadership, isn't it? That we think because we're the leader, I need to be in there directing, but actually...
They need me to tell them what to do. They don't. You've given them the framework. Now let them figure it out. And if you've set it up right, then they'll come back to you if they need more guidance or more help. And I think the worst thing, and you can trace yourself back, as you said, you know, you can relate that you were that guy on the ground during the point in your career. And someone calling you every 10 minutes or every hour is the last thing that you want. And so if I relate that to my world, it's not that level of frequency, but it's they just need time to figure it out themselves and be left alone. And when you're growing an organization, when you're doing a lot of change, that's, you know, the leader's busy. I'm over here, I'm over there. Once everything's in the shape that you want it, that's when you have to be very, very patient and you have to be very disciplined with yourself not to throw, oh, I've got another idea, let's throw it out into there. And it's something we're very disciplined as an organization. So our monthly reviews, we don't look at KPIs as such. We look at key projects that are going to drive the future KPIs. And we use that as a discipline so that people don't just dial up projects left, right, and center. Because what I've seen in every organization I've worked in is everybody's kind of working on different projects and then trying to pull everyone else's time. Often a lot of things don't ever get delivered. So you're working on, you know, you start 100 things, you progress 50 things, and you finish 5 things. And those 5 things are finished suboptimally. This is right, we'll have 10 things and we'll finish 10 things properly and then we'll start the next 10 things. Now they're, you know, these are all fluid, so you don't literally finish 10 and start 10, you finish, you know, what. And we have this meeting to hold us all to account. Are we working on these things? Is there anything we're working on that isn't on this list? Should we be working on it? If so, let's swap something off this list and put it on. And the progress we've made on meaningful things has been absolutely enormous doing that versus everywhere else I've worked where everyone kind of works on projects.
Mm-hmm. Have you read the book, The 4 Disciplines of Execution?
I have not. Is this one I've got to get out of the library?
Yeah, well, you probably don't based on what you've just said. So it comes from sort of the Covey family and Institute. But in there, they cite some research conducted by Gallup where they talk about running a business being like a whirlwind. It's all the day-to-day stuff that has to happen. And then it talks about how many projects you can take on and deliver with excellence in addition to the whirlwind. And if memory serves me correctly, they say 3 to 5 in addition to the whirlwind, you can deliver those 3 to 5 with excellence. I think it says 7 to 10 extra projects, you'll deliver 1 to 2 with excellence. And then 11 plus number delivered with excellence goes to 0. So it absolutely is law of diminishing returns.
Yeah, that count assumes there is some central coordination. I think my experience is everybody sort of kicks off their own projects and tries to pull the other teams they need, the other expertise they need to support them. There's no sort of view of whether they're the right projects even in the first place. So even if you deliver them well, do they have the impact? Are you measuring the impact? Are you doing the other things around them to make sure that they have the maximum impact that they could have? So yes, I think that sounds like a valuable study that I will need to go and read and that people should look up because it's certainly true in my experience.
Yeah, well, for everybody listening at home or on your commute, well, I'll pop the link to the book in the show notes and I'll share it with you, Andy. Very conscious of your time. So let me just wrap up by asking the standard question I ask every guest as we close out the show. What would you say is the best mistake that you've ever made? Or in other words, one what seemed like a mistake but turned out to be very fortuitous?
Yes, I'm gonna close the circle and kind of end where I started. And it would be when I worked at Arcadia. I left Amazon, where I had a very successful career. I joined a business that history has told was a flawed culture. There was nothing wrong with the business. I think many people loved the brands and the products they sold, but there was, you know, something at its core that meant that business wasn't successful. And I definitely feel like I experienced that. But I was very humble in the way that I took that experience, even though there was a lot wrong with the way Arcadia ran itself, in my experience. There was a lot wrong with how I was as well. So for the fit to not be there, it takes two. So it was at least 50% me if it was 50% them. And, you know, it can be 70, I don't, it doesn't matter. But what I took from that was a huge amount of learnings of, well, what, how did I want to be as a leader? How did I want to behave? And if I hadn't had that experience, I do think I probably would have made a lot of those mistakes coming into whatever company, to coming into Space NK. So my failures at Arcadia meant that I could be successful at Space NK. And the humility that it taught me, and the acceptance of, as I said, you know, all those negative experiences to fill in the blanks of, okay, well, I haven't got a role model of how to act in this situation, but I've done it wrong, so that's a blueprint for how to do it better next time, means that I was a much better leader. And I said to the then CEO, Chris, at Space NK, when I joined, I said, just to let you know, and the business was doing okay. There were no burning platforms that needed fixing. So I say that as context, that I'm going to do nothing for 3 months. And he laughed, and I laughed. And then 2 months later, he sort of called me and says, obviously, we'd had lots of meetings in between, but I remember 2 months later, he said, what are you doing? I said, no, I've got another month. I told you I wasn't going to do anything for 3 months. And he said, oh, I thought you were joking. And I was like, no, because I've built the relationships now. I've earned the respect. I've understood how everything is done here. I've understood this culture. And now very, very gently, I can start changing it to what I think it needs to be. And I did. So pretty much on 3 months and a day, I made some pretty big changes, and they were pretty painful. Again, you know, I don't want this to be the clipped part of this podcast, but again, I made some organizational changes within the e-commerce team. I had some people in tears. I had threats of people who were going to leave and quit. But in that case, within 2 weeks, they were like, actually, you were right. Because the organization that I had was one of, everybody had a bit of everything, and I changed it to one where you have complete ownership and autonomy of this thing. So you can do it any way you want. This is your framework. Go and have a play in that and get a better outcome than the one you've got. And you don't have to check in with 6 people. You don't have to get permission from loads of people. So that was the sort of change that I made. But I built the relationships to lean on when I had those difficult conversations and the tears and the threats. I was like, we built the trust. You can trust me. You know, if it doesn't work, I'll change it again. But trust me, go on this journey with me. So that was the best mistake I've made, is a pretty massive failure. And what I should add, because I think it's important for the audience, is I was fired from Arcadia. Like, I didn't leave, and the business didn't go. I wasn't there when the business went under. So I don't think failures get much bigger than that, do they? Getting fired from a director role in a large multinational company.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, the honesty and openness to share that. And I promise the episode title won't be How to Make People Cry and Leave Your Organization.
How to Make Your Team Cry During a Reorganization.
Yeah. But to your point as well, that's a lovely opportunity you've given me to also bring it full circle. Like, I've got a very similar experience at Tesco where it was 50-50. I wasn't right for Tesco when I worked there, and that organization and culture wasn't right for me. But again, I learned a huge amount around how to get stuff done, even more about the type of leader I didn't want to be, and therefore how I did want to show up. And would I go back and change that? I don't think I would. And maybe I might have made a decision. I might have my time again. I might have decided to leave earlier. But I would never have not had that experience. And I mean, that's why, hopefully, that's the value of this podcast. Whilst I said earlier, some lessons we just need to learn ourselves, and it can be hard to take on advice from other people. But for chatting with people like yourself, kind of me sharing some of my own stories, hopefully sort of people can live by that Chinese proverb that says, the wise person learns from their mistakes, the wiser person learns from the mistakes of others. So hopefully we can be of service. Andy, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. It's been a fascinating conversation. And I frequently say this, but 100% true. I could have carried on chatting for another hour if we both had it. So thank you very much. I'm sure everybody listening has got a huge amount of value from what you shared today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that episode as much as I enjoyed recording it with Andy. And before you go, let me just say that if Andy's comments there about finding a confidant, mentor, or coach resonated with you, then do remember to take a look at the coaching and mentoring pages on my website. It's ben-morton.com. And if you like what you see, then do get in touch either via the website or the links I've put for you in the show notes to book your free discovery call with me. And let's have a chat and see if we might be a coaching match. That's it for this episode, though. Look after yourself. Look after those you've got the privilege and responsibility to lead. And as always, lead on.